This is VOA News. I'm Lori London. President Donald Trump's former personal lawyer Michael Cohen pleaded guilty Thursday to a new charge of lying to Congress about a Russian real estate venture Trump sought to develop during his presidential campaign. AP's Warren Levinson has more.
Michael Cohen told a Manhattan federal judge he lied to Senate and House committees last year about Donald Trump's business interests in Russia. He testified negotiations over building a Trump Tower in Russia ended before the 2016 presidential primaries began, when in fact they continued throughout the primary season. He also said he lied about the extent of his contacts in Russia and with the Trump Organization about the project. He said he lied to be loyal to Trump's political messaging, though the boss's name was absent from the proceeding, where Trump was called Individual One. Warren Levinson, New York.
The developments come as Trump continues almost daily attacks on Mueller's investigation of Trump campaign links to Russia and whether Trump as president obstructed justice in an effort to thwart the probe. British security contractor G4S says five of its employees, including a Briton, were killed and 32 others injured in a gun and bomb attack against one of its compounds in the Afghan capital of Kabul. The company said in a statement Thursday that five employees have been seriously injured. Afghan officials confirming the attack on the well-guarded facility in Kabul that it killed a total of 10 people and injured many more. The Taliban has claimed responsibility for the suicide raid, saying it inflicted heavy casualties on both Afghan and foreign occupying forces inside the compound. The G4S is a leading global security company which provides security for the British Foreign Commonwealth Office in Afghanistan. This is VOA News. U.S. President Donald Trump Thursday abruptly canceled a planned two-hour meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in response to Moscow's seizure of Ukrainian ships in the Black Sea region. The White House said Trump made the decision on board Air Force One after conferring with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, National Security Advisor John Bolton, and White House Chief of Staff John Kelly. Russia seized three Ukrainian vessels and their crews in the Kerch Strait as they tried to make their way to the Ukrainian port of Mariupol in the Sea of Azov. What does Michael Cohen's guilty plea mean in the bigger picture of the Russia probe? Well, AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has this.
GOP Senator Lindsey Graham, a Trump supporter, has no idea.
I don't know what it means in terms of the president and his campaign.
Saying the ball's in special counsel Bob Mueller's court.
Eventually, Mr. Mueller is going to have to show the public, there's collusion or there's not.
Fellow Republican John Kennedy agrees.
We do need to wrap it up.
Democrat Tim Kaine says the Cohen plea could mean Republicans get their wish, in a sense.
It definitely feels like there's an accelerating pace now.
And though former federal prosecutor David Weinstein says it's unlike President Trump to admit being nervous,
he should be getting a lot more nervous because the circle around him is tightening.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
Senior U.N. advisor to the special envoy for Syria, Jan Egeland, accuses the international community of cruelty, disregarding the suffering of the Syrian people and failing to protect them in the name of waging a war against terror. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Egeland says this policy has unleashed more than 7 years of fierce fighting, killing hundreds of thousands of people and displacing millions within the country and as refugees.
This notion that everyone is fighting terror fuels the fierceness and fuels the devastation that engulfs the civilians.
While most of the country has been forcibly pacified, Egeland warns the humanitarian situation throughout Syria remains critical. He says he is particularly worried by a recent escalation of violence in the northern cities of Aleppo and Idlib. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The World Health Organization warns a spike in the number of measles cases globally is putting hard-won progress toward the elimination of this highly contagious, deadly disease at risk. Martin Fried is the World Health Organization's Director of Immunization, Vaccines, and Biologicals.
We are seeing sustained measles transmission in countries that had previously not seen measles transmission for many years.
I'm Lori London, VOA News in Washington.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Friday, November 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The United States praises Ethiopia's critical role in Africa.
As His Excellency likes to say, the Horn of Africa is now the hope of Africa, and how dramatically things have changed, all for the better, and thanks again to Ethiopia's tremendous initiatives in this regard.
Thibault Nagy is the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. A new report accuses Uganda of violating European Union arms embargo against South Sudan. Liberia's former vice president will launch a foundation today to improve the lives of Liberians. And Nigeria's government denies it failed to protect its citizens following a surge in Boko Haram violence.
I think one setback should not be enough. For us to conclude that the federal government is not winning the war, I want to assure you that you are going to see a remarkable improvement in the fight against Boko Haram.
Lai Mohammed is Nigeria's information minister, will examine the negative effects of lack of research in Africa, and Senegal criticizes a report on teacher abuse in secondary schools. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs has praised Ethiopia's role in Africa, from helping to bring about peace in Somalia to facilitating regional and continental understanding. Thibault Nagy spoke Thursday in Addis Ababa after meeting with Ethiopian Foreign Minister Wokne Gebeyahu.
The United States of America greatly values Ethiopia's role in the Horn of Africa, in all of Africa. We have a number of very important issues that we work together on closely, and I greatly appreciate the advice of His Excellency on how to deal with some of the regional issues that we face together.
So would you mind telling us the very specific things you talked with?
No, not the very specific things. I mean, obviously, diplomatic communication has its discretion, but you can imagine looking around the region, all of the issues of importance. I mean, look around the neighborhood, number one, as it is now, but also look around the neighborhood how it was before the current government undertook their tremendous initiatives to open the doors with Eritrea, to help relations between Eritrea and Djibouti. The region looks so much different now. As His Excellency likes to say, the Horn of Africa is now the hope of Africa, and how dramatically things have changed, all for the better, and thanks again to Ethiopia's tremendous initiatives in this regard.
What should we expect?
Well, relations have always been strong between Ethiopia and the U.S. We have not been around for 2,000 years like you have. If we had, I'm sure that we would have had, good, strong relations for 2,000 years. But right now, we have so many issues where we can cooperate together and help each other. Whether it's bringing peace to Somalia, whether it's opening up the relations between the countries in the region, whether, of course, Ethiopia gets tremendous credit for its many peacekeeping operations for the United Nations. Ethiopia is one of the critical countries in Africa. So it's very, our relations are very, very important.
Has there been any request from the Ethiopian government to freeze assets of individuals suspected of gross human rights violations?
If there were, I couldn't comment on that. That's how we say, neither confirm nor deny. But we don't talk about those types of things publicly.
Yeah. Is there a U.S. policy shift towards the Horn of Africa vis-a-vis the normalization of relations between Ethiopia and Eritrea, and also the ongoing reforms in Ethiopia?
Again, I wouldn't say that there is a shift towards. It's just that the region, the entirety of the region, is so much more positive now from all aspects, whether it's trade and investment, whether it's external relations. And of course, one of my big, big priorities is trade and investment. Because again, one of the reasons I took this job coming back is the tremendous youth growth in Africa, and is going to be critically important for the youth to really have very productive, positive jobs when they enter the job market.
That's U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Tibor Nash, speaking after meeting with Ethiopian Foreign Minister Wokner Gebeyehu in Addis Ababa. The Nigerian government has denied it failed to protect its citizens following recent surge in Boko Haram violence. Information Minister Lai Mohammed says government security measures are continuing to protect Nigerians. His remarks came after President Muhammadu Buhari went to Maiduguri to visit soldiers who are fighting against Boko Haram militants.
I think one setback should not be enough for us to conclude that the federal government is not winning the war. And I want to assure you that you are going to see remarkable improvement in the fight against Boko Haram at the end of this meeting, and that everything is put in place to ensure that we reverse the fortunes of Boko Haram. But you must not forget that this is nothing but a temporary isolated setback.
How do you respond to critics who say that the government has failed in its core mandate, which they said constitutionally is to protect life and property and to maintain the country's territorial integrity, and now the fight being undertaken by the Boko Haram to attack Nigerians at will, including the military, with reports of 72 Nigerian soldiers killed, is a sign that the government has failed? How do you respond to that?
Well, in the first instance, whoever makes that statement is, I think, taking the matter out of context. For you to really evaluate and judge what this government has achieved in the fight against Boko Haram, let's wind the clock back to pre-2015, where not even Abuja was safe. You remember pre-2014, 2015, nobody in Abuja could sleep with his two eyes closed because Boko Haram attacked Abuja four times. The first was the United Nations headquarters, followed by the headquarters of the police, then the news, this day newspaper headquarters, and there are two times they attacked the motor park in the capital. I make bold to say that in 2015 there had been no such attack in the state capital. Again, wind back the clock. I remember that, pre 2015, Boko Haram was active in at least 10 states of the Federation: Niger, Kano, Sokoto, Bauchi, Gombe, Borno, Yobe, and the like, where they were pummeling the federal troops. But today, we've been able to confine them to just not even to a state, because we're driven away from Nigeria. They now operate to attack vulnerable targets from the Lake Chad Island. When we came in 2016, 20 out of 27 local governments in Borno State alone was under the effective occupation of Boko Haram. Today, not one inch of our territory is being occupied by them. So it's completely illogical for anybody to say the federal government has failed in its responsibility to protect lives and property.
Lai Mohammed is Nigeria's information minister. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from Abuja. Former Liberian Vice President Joseph Boakai will today, Friday, launch his development foundation to help address the needs of the citizens, because he says government alone cannot solve all the problems of the country. He says the Joseph Newman Boakai Foundation will seek to empower the youth in the areas of agriculture, education, as well as establish medium enterprises. Vice President Boakai spoke to reporter Moses Gaziowu in this exclusive interview in the Liberian capital, Monrovia.
I've always told people that my love for humanity and my love to see things happening in the lives of people had always been the drive towards whatever I do. I felt that after the election, that was not the end of the world. We have a country that is in dire need of all of the support. I've been in this country, I've been around the country, I know the lives that our people are living, I know the condition under which they're living, I know their needs in agriculture, I know their need in the health sector, I know the need of the youth and gender issues, and I believe that after the election, it is something that we would like to continue to do, because some of the things that we are going to do are things that we already have started doing. We need to cater to the needs of our people to take their lives outside government. And so the foundation is what I want to use to get a support to be able to render services to our people in the various areas I've already mentioned.
Basically, what will be the key focus areas?
Some of these need cut across each other because, for example, when you talk about agriculture, the need for food security, the need for the farmers to be able to have quality seed for their farming, to help them organize their farming in a proper way, to make them know that they can make a living out of agriculture. And comes hand in hand with that is water. We have been around this country, so many NGOs come to give water. You go around, people still don't have good drinking water. And also talking about education, we know there are a lot of education programs all over the country. But you go to some classrooms, children have no books, the school's not looking the best. So we believe that we as citizens of the country should not just look on and say, well, the government do it and government do it. So my experience here and my passion is to see that life improve for people. So our strategy is what we call collective impact.
You just come from the back of losing elections and you still want to do it.
I do not consider myself a business person. I don't consider myself a politician. I consider myself someone who loves humanity. So that job does not end at election. It's what is in me, and that's what I want to do. I came from a very, very difficult background, self-supporting, and I know you read right before you that I gave not because I have, but because I know what it means to be without. And I know what it means for people to be without.
That's former Liberian Vice President Joseph Boakai speaking in Monrovia with Moses Gaziewu. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Friday, November 30th. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. A new report by the London-based Conflict Armament Research accuses Uganda of diverting European procured weapons to South Sudan, which the group says has helped fuel South Sudan's five-year conflict. But a military spokesman says the government acquired the weapons to protect the country against rebels. Dimo Silva Arroyo reports from Juba.
The 101-page report says a network of U.S. and Ugandan companies controlled by British, Israeli, Ugandan, and American nationals procured a military jet from the United States and an Australian-made surveillance aircraft. Since 2014, the report says at least two of SOA companies registered in Seychelles acted as brokers or intermediaries in actual or attempted arms supplies to South Sudan. A third Seychelles company brokered the export of ammunition from Romania via the Slovak Republic of Uganda in 2015, according to Conflict Armament Research Report. It documents hundreds of weapons and more than 200,000 rounds of ammunition used in the conflict. Ugandan government spokesman Ofondo Opondo did not respond to repeated calls or a text message requesting an interview from South Sudan in Focus. On July 13th, the UN Security Council slapped an arms embargo on South Sudan, but military supplies outlined in this report entered South Sudan much earlier. The findings suggest that neither the original supplier companies nor the U.S. or Australian governments were aware that their aircraft were being used in the retransfer of weapons to the South Sudan government. The report says the retransfers from Uganda to South Sudan may have breached end-use or non-transfer commitments made to exporters as a prior condition of sale. South Sudan's military spokesman, Major General Lul Roy Kwong, says South Sudan acquired such armament in order to protect the government against the SPLA-IO.
We did what was required of us to restock, to resupply, and defend the territorial integrity of the country and defend the democratic government from being toppled using illegal means. These equipment were purchased, whether they came through Uganda or they did not come through Uganda. We heard a good reason. At the time, the National Army was fighting a rebellion.
The report says Israel, Ukraine, and United Arab Emirates and China had stopped supplying ammunition to South Sudan since 2013. But Kwong says South Sudan is a sovereign country and has the rights to enter into contractual deals with any country it wishes for its supply of weapons now that the warring parties have signed a peace deal.
all the countries you had referred to stopped dealing with us. Maybe they did so because they were complying with the international requirements that you should not continue dealing with the South Sudan army because they are at war. But now that the peace agreement has been signed, the same partners would be dictated by the reality that this country has signed peace agreement.
The report also documented secret shipments of Sudanese and Chinese manufactured weapons from Sudan to opposition fighters in South Sudan by air and land from 2014 until at least mid-2015. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
A recent study by a group of African researchers addressed the root causes and negative effects of what they say is a lack of research on the continent. Lem Ngonganghala, one of the authors of the report, tells Ricky Stryak that many African countries do not provide the basic resources to enable researchers.
The root causes for this lack of research I can summarize them in two very broad factors. So the first one is the research environment, the availability of resources and support. So things like funding, which is a major challenge, and research facilities, training opportunities. The second thing is the research culture in Africa. So a positive research culture is one that the need for research is appreciated, and there's motivation to start doing research or to continue doing research. But unfortunately, that's not the case in many African countries. And this contributes to, you know, demotivating current or potential researchers.
What are some of the effects of that research gap?
African countries have been struggling with so many challenges for so many years, you know, from health challenges to poverty and development issues. The lack of sufficient research in Africa takes away the capacity for African countries to identify and deal with their own problems. You know, without reliable research, how will African countries be able to build the local evidence base that they need to inform policymaking? Or how do they even get to tell what programs are working or what's not working, what difference can be made, you know?
And what steps can be taken and by whom do they need to be taken in order to increase research in Africa?
The very first key step is to increase locally led research in Africa. African researchers, research institutions, organizations, leaders, and what have you, they need to step up to the challenge and identify what they can do for themselves. And also, African researchers need to work together. They need to increase research collaboration amongst themselves. If African researchers can work together, this will help to identify potential solutions that can be replicated in other parts of the continent or scaled up to increase impact. Now, the next factor is African governments need to increase support for research in Africa. Increasing the amount of funding would enable institutions in Africa to provide the training that researchers need. One additional factor as well, in my opinion, that could influence research, and this is about the research culture in Africa.
That was Lem Ngonganghala, co-author of Research Challenges in Africa. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. Abuse of Senegalese girls in secondary schools, including sexual exploitation, is widespread, according to a recent Human Rights Watch report that documents incidents of gender-based violence and harassment around the country. But as Sophia Christensen reports from Dakar, authorities and teachers have denounced the report as poorly researched.
When she was in fourth grade, a teacher offered to help Awa, who does not wish to use her real name, with her homework after school. Awa still recalls the day she went to her teacher's house in her native village of Dagan, 15 years ago.
He was asking me questions and I was answering him, but after a while, he started putting his hands on my body. I pushed him away and ran home.
For the rest of the school year, Awa lived in fear, as the teacher threatened to fail her for rejecting his advances. In October, Human Rights Watch reported that sexual exploitation of schoolgirls in Senegal is widespread. Most cases of abuse are settled at the community level, but culprits are rarely punished, says community leader Ibrahim Hassan.
In our country, going to the police can be difficult. You need to be someone. A nobody like me will struggle.
Human Rights Watch has called in Dakar to ban sexual relations between teachers and students, and to start sex education programs in schools. But Senegal's teachers' unions have responded by dismissing the report.
manquer un tout petit peu de respect aux enseignants.
It's a bit disrespectful because with a population of 90,000 teachers, focusing on just three or four regions and about 100 students cannot be representative of Senegal.
Meanwhile, Senegal's education ministry has rejected the idea of introducing sex education. Sophia Christensen for VOA News, Dakar.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin with World Football Ruling Body FIFA's latest ranking for the month of November. Senegal replaced Tunisia as the highest-ranked African national team when the monthly statistics were released by FIFA on Thursday. The Senegalese rose from second place on the back of a 2019 African Cup of Nations qualifying victory in Equatorial Guinea during November. Tunisia lost away to Egypt in the same competition and were also beaten at home by Morocco in a friendly. Only five African countries, Senegal, Tunisia, Morocco, Nigeria, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, were among the top 50 in the world. In the CAF Confederations Cup, AS Vita will look for a miraculous turnaround when they host the second leg of the 2018 CAF Confederations Cup final against Raja Casablanca. The match is set for Stade des Martyrs in Kinshasa on Sunday night. The Moroccans are in a powerful position in the tie after claiming a 3-0 home win in Casablanca last week. A brace from Sofiane Rahimi and a penalty from Mohamed Benhalib saw Juan Carlos Garrido's side put one hand on the trophy. Should they wrap up the triumph, it will be the Green Eagles' second Confederations Cup title. Their first arrived in 2003 when the competition was still known as the CAF Cup. Some football fans tells me that Raja's victory in the first leg is a huge advantage.
For Raja winning that first leg by 3-0 in Morocco, it's a dungeon already. But take nothing away from AS Vita. I'm giving it to Raja already, but of course in football anything can happen.
And now to the African Women's Cup of Nations holding in Ghana. South Africa's women's national football team will on Saturday challenge Nigeria's Super Falcons for the 2018 African Women's Nation Cup title. Bayana Bayana, who have impressed throughout the tournament, overcame Mali in the semi-final, pitting two unanswered goals past the female Eagles. In the other semi-final, Nigeria and Cameroon played out a goalless draw, including a barren period of extra time. The defending champions went on to win the resulting penalty shootout 4-2. The Nigerian Super Falcons will be seeking revenge against Bayana Bayana, who stunned them 1-0 in their opening game at Alcon 2018. Thomas Denabi is Nigeria's Super Falcons coach.
Extremely happy. And of course, when we come to the final, we will do whatever it takes, trying to bring back the cup to Nigeria.
Coach Desri Ellis is the Bayana Bayana coach.
You know, they've been encouraging, they've really been motivating and been real team players. And for us, that is very important. We pride ourselves on being a team. We pride ourselves on being together, and they really have.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And we look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that is it for this Friday, November 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the role of political parties in Africa. Is there room for opposition political groups? Does the African citizen have a right to form an independent opinion? Those issues and more on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.